You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
The Air Station 1 podcast has been bringing your inner geek out to play for the past 13 years. Over this time, we've seen things change in the world of geek and podcasting alike.
And your friends here at ESO are looking to change also. We are now giving you double the fun by coming to you twice a week, and not just in audio, but now you can see our lovely faces up on YouTube.
Join Mike and Mike as we celebrate our 700th episode and beyond. Air Station 1 is proud to be a founding member of the ESO Network.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We are going back to the Halls of Hammer for this week's episode, and this is sort of a film that was at a point in Hammer's history where things were radically changing for the film studio. Now, we've done a ton of Hammer films, and of course, I can't say enough about how much, as a kid, I loved Hammer movies. The first time I got introduced to them with the horror of Dracula and then all of the Frankenstein movies, right up into the 70s. They were one of my favorite studios of all time, like many of you. In fact, we've been getting a lot of requests for us to go back and do some more Hammer films. And since season 7 of Monster Attack has been really a season of change, and a season of development. We've had, all kinds of unusual things happening with having to shut down for 3 months and then come back up before our 7th anniversary. I thought this was an appropriate film to do because it's one that doesn't get a whole lot of discussion. This is a time when Hammer had really hit their stride. They had really crested, and this was 1970. And they did actually 2 Dracula films in this year. In July of 1970, they released Taste the Blood of Dracula. And then they did this one, The Scars of Dracula, was released later on in the year, near the end of the year. Very, very unusual. They'd never done that before. But there's a big difference between Taste the Blood and Scars in that during this time period, Warner Brothers, which had a great relationship with Hammer Films on a distribution deal, which allowed them to distribute their films in the United States, had decided when they had pitched Scars of Dracula to them, they didn't want to finance it. They wanted to quit handling Hammer Films. Felt like that they had done all that they could do, and in all honesty, the quality was dropping a little bit. Yeah, you could tell that the franchise was getting a little tired. Now, I like Taste the Blood of Dracula. We have not talked about that one, but we will on a future show. It's one I especially liked from this time period. And, of course, we've talked about Dracula AD 72, which would come 2 years after this one, another one that I thought quite a bit about. Scars shows a little bit of some of the issues that were going on with Hammer Films at the time. They had to get a different distributor. The budget gets slashed, so they're only producing this film on $200,000 compared to the bigger budgets that they did with the earlier Hammer Films. And folks, I got to, in all honesty, I'll tell you right now, I like Scars of Dracula. There are some issues with it that we'll talk about here. We try to be as upfront and honest as we can with these. But again, sharing my experience with the film, this is a film that I saw later on in life. In 1970, I was in high school at that time. I was a sophomore/junior in high school. So this is one I would have seen at the movie theater, but I didn't catch this one at the movie theaters. Scars was released on a double bill in some parts of the country with the horror of Frankenstein. You remember that was the Ralph Bates Frankenstein film. We talked about Ralph Bates and Veronica Carlson's were the two stars in that one. I think we talked about that about three seasons ago, if I'm not mistaken. I missed that one. This was all during that time that I was moving from New York to North Carolina, and a couple of them got by me. I don't think actually this film ran at any of the theaters in Raleigh. It might have. I was just getting used to discovering which theaters ran the monster movies and which ones didn't. So it would have been very easy for it to escape my, you know, my gaze, so to speak, getting adjusted to a brand new city, moving from the north to the south, and all of the trauma and stuff that went with that, starting a new high school and all that. So it's very possible it may have come into Raleigh and I just missed it. But I didn't see this until much later. I saw it on cable, and I was just out of college when I saw it. So, you know, the more in my adult years, this was the first R-rated Hammer film that was released, and then they would go on and do it. But we had seen sort of a movement within Hammer films. You know, they were always known for what we would call the cleavage films. You know, they did the big bustiers, the beautiful women and all that. There was a sensuality about the Dracula films of Hammer. That was one thing that, as a kid, it really attracted me because it was a little different than the Dracula movies I had seen. And I, you know, as you know, I loved the Bela Lugosi Dracula. I still do. I still think it is one of the best films that Universal made during this time and one of the top vampire films ever made. You know, we've talked a lot about Brides of Dracula, which I still think may be the overall best vampire film, in my opinion, that was ever made. But, Hammer was moving a little bit more and more to things, more sensual type approaches. Of course, Christopher Lee's Dracula, was a monster, but he also used sensuality to lure in his victims, before he went in for the kill. So there was more of an air of sexuality about the Hammer films in the 60s than other vampire films were out there. And it was that difference in the writing that attracted me as a kid. And I think a lot of us that were monster kids back then, that it was something that made these movies different. Well, Scars of Dracula takes it a little further. There's a lot more sensuality in this. A lot of it is in the very beginning of the movie, and I do want to warn parents that there is a brief scene of nudity in this one. It's fairly tame. You've got a young rapscallion, I'm going to call him, and we're going to tell you about all the characters and the actors that are in this in just a moment, who is having an affair with the Burgermeister's daughter, and he gets caught, and she grabs a towel and runs away, and is not wearing any clothes. We'll put it that way, so you see her from behind. So warning the parents out there that you will see that in this movie. It's very quick. It's a brief flash that you see in the beginning, and then it's pretty much that's it. But, you know, if your kids are going to watch it, you need to know this. But there is a sensuality that's a little more heightened in this film as Count Dracula, as portrayed by Christopher Lee, is zeroing in on various women that become victims. And specifically, and I noticed it more the older I got. I think as a kid in high school, I probably subliminally knew that there was some more sensuality to movies of this nature. But, it didn't really become apparent until I got into my older years, you know, my adult years. And I would start analyzing these films, and it would come in the attacks. And when Christopher Lee would, you know, hypnotize his victims, the female victims, and then go in, and these were the films that actually showed him biting his victims. You know, as you know, in the Universal films, you never really saw Bela Lugosi bite anybody. It was all implied. It was all left to your imagination, which I think made it even more horrific. But you see Christopher Lee go in, and then usually the cameras would concentrate on the face of the victim, and it would be an incredible mixture of shock, of fear, followed by ecstasy. I guess maybe ecstasy is a little bit too strong of a word, but you would have that mixture of emotions of the fear and the realization that you're being attacked by a monster, and then receiving some kind of sensual pleasure from the experience. And that was something that was a little different from Hammer. It was a real mark of what Hammer did, that approach that they took. I mean, monstrous attacks, but with that element of sensuality built into them. It made them very unique, and they're now at a point in 1970 where they take it up a little further, and they will in future films like Lust of a Vampire and Twins of Evil and others, where they, again, now we're getting into more of the R-rated films. Now, they were R-rated at the time. I think if these films were to be released today, they would be PG. Even with the quick flash of nudity in it, I think it would probably, because, I mean, this is the kind of thing you see on television now, you know, after hours on television, you know, after 9 o'clock on TV. You know, it's not unusual. Well, actually, even at 8 o'clock, it's not unusual to see this kind of thing on television. So, you know, things have changed as we've gotten, you know, 60 years beyond some of this, or 50 years in the case of this film. So we're in a period of transition here with our monster movies. And of course, those of us as monster kids during this time, we had to make the transition as well, as these movies moved into different terrain. Now, Scars of Dracula received a lot of criticism from the critics, from the big critics, when it was first released. A lot of them said, well, it was just a lot of the same thing over and over again. Nothing new here. And I'm very, very critical of, you know, in the past, I've been very critical of some of the big time critics, because they don't really understand, for the most part, monster movies. But I got to sort of agree with them on this, but it didn't affect me in a negative way, because yes, Scars of Dracula does employ a lot of the same conventions that we have seen in Hammer's other Dracula films. In fact, this one reminded me quite a bit of Dracula, Prince of Darkness, because you have a situation where someone is lost or whatever out in the middle of nowhere. They make it into Dracula's castle. He welcomes them in and then makes them victims. You know, this is a tried and true formula that Hammer had used many times over. And, you know, it's a variation of that same vehicle here. And I'm not saying that as a critical element in my experience with this film. At this time, like I said, I loved going to see Hammer films, and I knew what I was going to get with a Hammer Dracula film. So when I saw Scars of Dracula for the first time, even though they employed pretty much the same formula they had used in many other films, that was okay with me, because that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted out of a Hammer film. So I think this is where the critics sort of missed the point. The film is not boring. I don't think it's slow, and it's very entertaining. And I just watched it again a couple of nights ago, and I hadn't seen it in a while. In fact, there's a lot about this film I had forgotten about from the last time I'd seen it. That's how long it had been. And it still played very well with me. I still like this movie. Acting is very well, although a lot of the actors I didn't know. Well, a few of them I know. We're going to get to that right now. So this was a mixture of some new faces with some old veteran faces that you're going to recognize. The film was directed by Roy Ward Baker. And of course, I guess the first film I was really aware of by Roy Ward Baker was not a monster movie, but was a film about the Titanic, A Night to Remember. Still to this day, one of my favorite Titanic movies. I actually prefer it over James Cameron's Titanic. Because I felt like they stayed truer to the actual story of what happened on the ship. And that is one of those films that is in that category that if it's on and I have an opportunity, I have the time to watch it, I will always watch it. I never get tired of watching that particular film. Roy Ward Baker did several films for Hammer as well, and a good director. I mean, he's a good no-nonsense director. The only film of his that I had a little trouble getting into, and it's one we're probably going to talk about down the road, and that was The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, which is one of those films that came out by Hammer that people either really, really like or just sort of, it's okay. But Roy did a lot of, he did work for Amicus as well as Hammer. He's the one that did Asylum. He also did The Monster Club. And for Monster Kids, there were a lot of films that he did that we recognized, and quite a versatile director. 65 credits altogether. He directed right up until 1992, and did a lot of TV work as well as film work. And I liked what he did. We lost Roy in 2010. He lived a long, long life, 93 years old. And he's a guy that just, came up through the ranks as a second unit director, an assistant director, worked on various aspects of Cruise, and before he got his break in directing. And, Hammer was good to him, as well as some of the other horror studios and other dramatic studios. So I think he does a great job on this. And, again, with a nice blend of veterans and newer faces. Now, Christopher Lee, of course, is our headliner. And again, when Hammer was releasing any kind of a Dracula film, if Christopher Lee did agree to be in it, then he was the headliner. He was the draw for all of us monster kids from this time period when a Hammer film came out. He was definitely one of my favorites as Dracula. He and Lugosi will be the top two in my book. And David Peel is a very, very, very close to those two. I almost put him up on an equal basis with Lee and Lugosi, except that he's only got The Brides of Dracula as the only time he played a vampire. But I have a feeling that he could have made quite a career of it, because I thought he was a very, very effective, even though he's not officially Count Dracula. His vampire was quite effective, I thought, in that film. We're going to see in the lead male role, Dennis Waterman. Now, this is a guy that Roy Ward Baker didn't really want, but it was one that Hammer wanted. So he was stuck with him. And for many years, Roy said that he thought this film was miscast using Dennis Waterman in the character. I think he might be a little hard on him. I think Dennis does a pretty good job with this. Dennis was ended up having a really nice career, 89 credits. He acted right up until 2020, and we lost him not too long ago at the age of 74 in May of last year. So just almost exactly a year ago is when he passed away. Just did several films. It wasn't just horror, but a lot of British film, a lot of television, like a lot of them did. He was also known for his stage work as well, as a lot of British actors were. And I don't know, I think his character in this is a young barrister, or, well, I should say he's studying law. He makes mention that he is going to be pursuing a law career. What we have is a trade-off between two brothers. We've got the ambitious older brother, who is played by Dennis. And then we've got the younger brother, and his character's name is Simon. And then we've got the younger brother, Paul, who is the rapscallion. He's the one I was making reference to, played by Christopher Matthews. And Christopher is one that I was not familiar with. I was not familiar with him as an actor. In fact, this is about the only film I am aware of that I can think of growing up that I saw him in. I mean, but he's still, a decent actor, and he plays this very, very well. He's probably going to be known by a lot of monster kids for a few episodes on Doctor Who during the 60s. He had 20 credits to his name. He acted right up until 2006, most of that in Great Britain. So Scream and Scream Again is about the only other horror film that I recall seeing him in. And he was a pretty good actor in this, very believable, and makes a good makes a good rapscallion, blonde hair, good looking, and he had a woman in every port, so to speak. And he reminds me a little bit of Francis Matthews's character in Dracula, Prince of Darkness. And I know that's a little bit of a stretch, but in that we also had the similar trade-off. There's a lot of similarities between the vehicles used in Scars and Dracula, Prince of Darkness, where you had an older brother and Francis Matthews played the younger brother who loved to have fun and all that. And then, you had the older brother who was, married, to Barbara Shelley's character. And she was, the staid and stoic, type woman. And, they had trouble with Francis Matthews's character. He buying drinks for everybody at the pub and all of that. And, that is sort of the character Paul Carlson, was, because, Simon, who is, engaged to Sarah, played by Jenny Hanley. Jenny, if you're into British television and British productions, you will recognize her. She is still with us as well as Dennis. They're both retired from the business. She got out of the business in the mid 80s, but was known for the Morecambe and Wise show. Some of those made it over here to the United States. She was on Return of the Saint, did a lot of appearances in British television. So you would probably recognize her, but then, the name is not going to, jump out at you. 27 credits altogether. So, a pretty nice career over in Great Britain with some appearances over here in the United States, mainly on the British TV that came over, in the 80s and the 90s. Very pretty and, plays this very well. They've got she's got a nice chemistry, with Dennis Waterman. So Simon and Sarah, are the two. She is more, I should say, forgiving and tolerant of Dennis. There's not a triangle there, of Paul. I get my names all mixed up here. She's very, very fond of Paul, and she says that, but it's not your traditional type of love triangle that you would tend to see in some Hammer and Amicus films, horror films of the time period. It's more like she's just very fond of him. He's the kid brother, and she gets a kick out of him. And, she and Simon are trying to take him under their wing, and sort of settle him down because he's always getting in trouble with these girls that he beds. And, when he beds the Burgermeister's daughter, that is big, big trouble, which causes him to have to go on the run and hide out for a little bit. And that is sort of at the crux of the story. You've got a small village that Paul will find himself in. After he has taken a carriage on the run, trying to get away from the Burgermeister and his guys, his police, who he is out for blood on this one. The Burgermeister is, after Paul has violated his daughter, so to speak. Of course, she was no saint either. It was a mutual type situation. But Paul finds himself after getting knocked off the carriage out in the middle of nowhere, making his way into this small town, a small burg. I mean, it's just a very, very small village that has been the victim of a vampire, of Count Dracula. You can see his castle from just outside of the town up on the hill. And this is not the Dracula you see in Dracula, Prince of Darkness. In fact, the one thing about Scars does not pick up where Taste the Blood of Dracula left off. So there's no continuity here, as we have seen in the previous Hammer films. There are a lot of film historians who thought and have speculated, and I can't prove this, but I tend to agree with them, that Hammer at this time sort of was what we would call rebooting the franchise, even though we didn't use that term back then. But just in case that Christopher Lee decided he had had enough and wasn't going to come back, they made this a little different. They didn't match it up with the timeline of Taste the Blood of Dracula, where Dracula meets his demise in an old church. In this one, we've got the townspeople wanting to take care of the Count. His remains in the beginning of the movie are seen in this secret room in the castle. And that's something that I was very intrigued with. This is not like a basement room or a room that's hidden within the castle proper. It's in an area that only Dracula could get to. It's a hole cut into the side of the castle that is on the side of the cliff, basically. So to get to this room, you would have to be Superman or a bat or have a rope or something to get into it, because there's one entrance in the middle of this cliff and in this room, which is part of the castle, but there's no entrance to get from the castle proper. And you know, so it's the perfect hiding place for his casket. We see that this bat, and unfortunately, this is the only downside of the whole film. And we've talked about this with numerous Hammer films, is their bats tend to be pretty chintzy. In this one, it's really bad. I mean, it's a big plastic bat. It's flying around. This movie goes back to the basics of Bram Stoker's novel. And there's mention of it made that Dracula is able to hold dominion over a lot of animals. And so in this movie, he does. He holds dominion over wolves and bats. And he not only has his human, and his name is Clove, by the way. That's one of the other similarities to Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Remember the acolyte in that movie was named Clove as well. Although it's not, I don't believe it is the same character. Again, I think this is a total reboot of the franchise, a total different storyline than what we had seen in the storyline that contained that movie. This bat is clearly acting under the orders of Dracula. He has attacked a girl, not Dracula, but the bat has attacked a young woman in this township. And we see the father, it's almost like a scene out of Frankenstein, with his father carrying his daughter through the little town square, up to the inn, and setting her down on a table there in the inn. And the innkeeper, played by our good friend Michael Ripper, decides that's enough. We're going to go get this guy. And the local priest says, you know what? I'm going to go with you as well. The priest is played by Michael Gwynn. So again, these are some of the familiar faces you're going to see here. Michael Gwynn, you'll remember, was in Revenge of Frankenstein. He was Carl. He was the one that they made out of the dead bodies. I don't want to call him the creature, because he actually looks sort of human in that one. And he would show up in tons of Hammer films. A very, very likable character in this. And the priest and the landlord of the inn, played by Michael Ripper, and some of the townspeople take off in the daytime. They wait. You know, the priest says, we got to wait until the sun comes up. They put all of the women in the town in the local church, so they will be protected. And they go to set out to destroy the vampire. And they go up to the castle. Clove is up there, but they are able to get him at bay. They set the castle on fire. And when they leave, it is fully engulfed in flames. And we and they assume that that should have taken care of Dracula. But unbeknownst to them, this secret room that is sort of embedded in the side of this mountain that nobody could get to is totally untouched. So Dracula is going to be okay, because the bat, when he attacked this young girl, brought some of the blood back. It's dripping out of his mouth. And as it flies into this room where Dracula's remains are, we just see the skeleton and the red-lined cape that Christopher Lee made famous in all of his portrayals of Dracula. The blood falls on the ashes, the remains of Dracula, and he is brought back. He's resurrected. So not quite as gruesome as the resurrection scene in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, but pretty much the same idea. So Dracula is now in full force. So let the games begin. Paul finds his way into this town, and of course, the first person he meets in the middle of the night is Julie, who is the daughter of the landlord. And of course, she puts a move on, makes a move to him, to get him to see if he'll stay the night and whatever, cause at first she says, oh, we don't have a room and all that, but he sort of, wins her over. He seduces her, but they are caught by Michael Ripper's character and he is thrown out. And that's how he ends up, walking to the castle and becoming a guest of Count Dracula and Clove. Well, it's his disappearance during the wedding announcement of Simon and Sarah, and I believe it was also Sarah's birthday, big celebration. They knew he was in trouble. He had shown up briefly and then took off, and they knew he was on the run. Been several days. Nobody knew where he was. Nobody had seen him. Of course, the Burgermeister's still looking for him. So they set out to find him, and they follow his trail. And, again, with a rapscallion like that, it's not too hard to find out where he is, but it brings them to the castle as well, and they become guests of Count Dracula. So, like I said, this is a vehicle we have seen many, many times. Now, the story has bounced back and forth between them looking for Paul and Paul's experience. Paul meets up with a gal by the name of Tanya. Tanya is a victim of Dracula. She is a vampire as well. And, of course, she seduces Paul, which is not too hard because Paul is a real hound. And, during that time, Dracula appears. Paul is attacked. Tanya is killed. And we don't really know what happens to Paul. But we can sort of figure that it probably did not go well for him. But Sarah and Simon don't know that. So when they get to the castle, they are convinced that Paul is up there because the innkeeper's daughter, when the innkeeper decides to throw them out, because, he basically, Simon accuses the landlord of lying to him about Paul. He says, I know Paul was here. He says, no, we haven't seen him. We don't know who he is. Once he's accused of being a liar, he throws them out. And the daughter, Julie, catches him off to the side and says, he's up at the castle. Go up there. That's where you're going to find him because that's where he was headed. Now, let me mention one thing. This is one thing about this film. By the way, folks, I'm going to spoil everything in this. But, it's stuff that we've seen in a lot of Hammer films. So I would still recommend watching this movie because I think it's very entertaining. The one just a gruesome scene in this movie. And I'm bouncing around. I'm not doing this chronologically. When the innkeeper and the men from the little village go up to kill Dracula when they set the place on fire and put all the women in the church for safety, they come back and they are horrified to discover that all of the women and everyone that was in the sanctity of the church has been brutally murdered. Bites all over them. This is the most graphic part of the film. You see, they've just been bitten all over, including the innkeeper's wife. So he has this thing now about the castle and all of that. And so when people question his judgment and stuff, that's why he's always throwing people out of his inn. And people just tend to end up at the castle. Well, it goes back and forth, and I won't go into a blow by blow, but obviously, Dracula has his eyes on Sarah. Simon is sort of very suspicious. He knows that Dracula has got Paul. He knows it. Paul found a way to get into the secret room that Dracula had for his casket, and that's where he met his demise. And Paul ends up finding his way down there too. He forces Clove to give him a rope, goes out a window, and he's able to rappel down to this opening where he knows the secret room is. And he gets in there and he finds Paul brutally murdered. He is brutally murdered. And Dracula confronts him. Now this is something, one thing this film does that I really like is they do make some reference to the novel, to Bram Stoker's novel, because we do see in this movie Dracula gets in and out of this room by scaling the wall, by scaling the precipice of this side of the castle, which is just this huge cliff that goes for like hundreds of feet down into this ravine. And this is the first time we've really seen that in any of the Hammer Dracula films, but there was something that was quite, quite prominent in the book. Well, this is all going to lead up to a big confrontation, and we do end up having a huge confrontation, between Dracula and Simon and Sarah. And, during that fight, let me say that, of course it happens during a thunderstorm. And that seems to happen a lot. And that's sort of a running theme in Hammer films, that it's almost like if you are taking on the vampire, it affects everything, the whole ecosystem, that brings an element of spirituality into it. But this is one of the more unusual ways that Dracula gets destroyed. So if you haven't seen the movie and you don't want to know, I'm getting ready to tell you what it is right now. So you might want to wait and go get a copy of this film and then watch it. By the way, this film can be found on streaming services, but most of them you're going to have to rent it. It'll be about like a $3 rental with someone like Vudu and YouTube and stuff, but it's been restored very nicely. So it's if you don't mind paying $3, it's not a bad film for that. But what ends up happening is Dracula is in this fight with Simon, who has grabbed this big metal post off of the one of the gateways on the roof of the castle, and Dracula, of course, takes it away from him. And as he is getting ready to strike Simon, he holds it high over his head, and it attracts a bolt of lightning, which strikes and comes down the metal pole. Now, that doesn't kill Dracula or doesn't destroy him, but it sets him on fire. It starts a fire. His cape catches on fire, and he quickly goes up in a huge ball of flame, and we see the end of Count Dracula as the film comes to an end with the corpse burning fiercely on the roof of the castle. And a lot of Hammer films end up with flames, not just Dracula ones, but a lot of the Frankenstein ones do. So again, a lot of familiarity here. I do want to mention Clove real quick because I haven't mentioned him. He's another familiar face you're going to see in this. Clove is played by Patrick Troughton. So Patrick Troughton, you're probably, if you're a monster kid my age, you're going to remember him from Doctor Who because he played the Doctor on three separate occasions. He was the second Doctor, and then he also reappeared a couple of times in the 1980s. So, and he plays our Clove. That's pretty much most of the recognizable people in this. I mean, you're going to see some faces that are familiar, but for the most part, you'll see a lot of new faces in there. And again, I think Roy Ward Baker is a little hard on Dennis Waterman because I thought as Simon, he did a pretty good job. And he plays it really, really close to the vest, he plays it like a stiff upper crust, future attorney. So, I don't know if that's what Roy was worried with. Not really sure who he had in mind, but, Hammer said, no, this is the guy you're going to do it with or nobody. And, I think he did a good job. I thought the casting in this was pretty good. It was really, everybody, the chemistry with everybody was very, very good. So I like this movie a lot, even though, yes, it's a lot of the same in some sense. It's a variation on a theme we have seen so many times in Hammer films. It's a little bittersweet because I know we're now getting into the time where Hammer starts losing it a little bit. They've definitely crested and they're sort of on a downslope with one exception. And again, I know I'm in the minority. Mark and I are both in the minority on this one. When it comes to Dracula 1972, because I really liked that film. Maybe because it was Caroline Monroe. But no, I mean, that was a film that I saw when I was in college. And it was one of those comfort films that I've talked to you about so much. When I got away to school, it was one of the first horror films that I saw, when I started at UNC and didn't really know a whole lot of people and just felt sort of overwhelmed with the size of the university, and the whole thing of going from high school to college and all of that. So when I planted myself in that little theater on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill that would show the monster movies, and they were showing Dracula AD 72, I was ready for a Hammer film, and it delivered for me. In all honesty, when Hammer starts getting into the Karnstein films and some of those, and again, they get very into some very sensuous films, and some we're going to talk about here, so parents be forewarned, we'll nibble on those a little bit, even though they're considered relatively tame nowadays, but they were, they were dicey back then. And again, I want to be true to the parents out there who are helping their kids learn about these monster movies through Monster Attack, and we really appreciate it. So we'll always let you know up front, Mom and Dad, if we're doing one that's a little dicey. This one sort of started setting it in that direction, and would follow that way through the Karnstein sagas. And, until Hammer sort of gave up the ghost finally and wrapped up doing horror for this time period. They would come back, a couple of decades later and start Hammer all over again and get back into the horror movie business as they are now. And they've put out some pretty good films, since they've been back. So Scars of Dracula from 1970, again, the second, Dracula film that was released that year. And it came out around Christmas time, and very unusual that they would release two Dracula films in the same year. But this one did have a lower budget, $200,000. I think they did extremely well for the fact that their budget was cut so badly on this, because because Hammer films, the one thing as a kid I loved about them was the look of them, the colors. There were period pieces, a great costuming. The sets were great. And you can tell when they show the initial shot of Dracula's castle sitting up on the mountain that it's a matte painting. And that was something that wasn't as pronounced in the earlier Hammer films. So, it's a picky little thing, but you could, you knew that was because of the budget. Was just not what they were more so accustomed to. I still think it's a good film. I think it's very entertaining. And if you're a fan of Hammer films from the 60s, I think you're going to like it. And I don't agree with the critics saying, it's just the same thing over and over again. Chance to see Christopher Lee playing Dracula. And he's got lines in this, even though he was still a little upset that he felt like his lines could have been better. But he does get to talk quite a bit in this version. So, Scars of Dracula from 1970. Hey, folks, following this show, next week, big show. We've got Shane and Madeline sitting in with us as we celebrate 7 years of Monster Attack. Our 7th anniversary show coming your way next Monday. I can't say enough to all of you out there listening to this podcast how much we appreciate you guys hanging with us all these years, especially this season, which looked like, in all honesty, folks, I didn't know what was going to happen there for a while during that 3-month period that I was trying to find a place to set up the studio and to find a place to live. It was excruciating at times not to be able to do this program, but you guys hung with us and came right back and encouraged me along the way. And so we will celebrate together next week with a very special episode of Monster Attack. Thank you so much for your support, folks, and we will see you next Monday.
After a long wait, new Doctor Who is on its way. We're gearing up to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the show with a brand new Doctor. Let's welcome Shuti Gatwa as the 14th Doctor.
No. Shooty is the 15th Doctor. David Tennant is the 14th Doctor.
Wait. I thought David Tennant was the 10th Doctor. Okay, I'm confused.
Confused? Well, your friends here at the Earth Station Who podcast are here to help you through all your Doctor Who questions. Check us out wherever fine podcasts are found.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.